fame is that I was the teacher of pure men. So there are many ways to make your mark in the world, and it's very nice to see him in situ, and I'm grateful to him and to Amanda for all the trouble they took to bring me here. I'm very glad to be here. As I worked on the talk, I expanded it a little bit, so it's also about blasphemy and skepticism and materialism and other stuff like that, but we'll see. It growed like Topsy as I worked on it. It's always a work in progress, and therefore I'm going to allow time for the Q&A, which is always my favorite part of any public interaction. So here we go. Throughout its long existence, Hinduism has held in creative suspension two very different movements. One is the dominant strain of ritual, celebration of life, of family, of children, of sexuality, of food and poetry and sculpture, and the worship of many gods. The other is the strain of philosophy or renunciation, of the drive to become released from the cycle of rebirth through denial of the senses, of family life, of children. These two paths have permeable boundaries. They live more or less peacefully side by side as available options for most Hindus, until more passionate and monotheistic strains of devotional Hinduism, or bhakti, developed after the 6th century CE. Later still, the philosophical strain inspired yet other forms of Hinduism, broader in their total scope, but containing within them a narrower and less tolerant streak as they came into contact with other civilizations, with Islam from the 7th century CE, but more intensely from the 13th century, then the British Raj from the 18th century, and then in late 20th century, America, and a broader global internet world. The cumulative effect of these encounters in present-day India has been an unprecedented form of repression that threatens freedom of speech. Today, I want to trace this historical development for you in the hope of shedding light on the present crisis, which I'll only come to at the very end of the talk. The early Upanishads around the 6th century BCE described these two paths as the life of those who sacrificed in the village versus those who meditated in the wilderness, or those who wanted to be reborn versus those who did not want to be reborn. There were animosities between the two subcultures, in particular hostility against renouncers mingled with the general respect for them, but by and large they challenged and nourished one another through continual contact. It's useful here to make a distinction between two aspects of religion: orthodoxy, believing the right thing, and orthopraxy, doing the right thing. Though the categories are rather crude and there are always exceptions, in general, Hinduism during the early period was far more orthoprax than orthodox. Dharma, which includes duty, religion, religious merit, morality, social obligations, justice, righteousness, and the law. Dharma regulated the way people behaved, particularly toward Brahmins, the highest class from which priests were drawn, and toward members of other castes, more than what people believed in, particularly with regard to the gods. The good old Oxford English Dictionary defines blasphemy as a profane speaking of God, this is a monotheistic dictionary, or B, sacred things, or C, impious irreverence. The ancient Indians had no concept of blasphemy in the sense of A, profane speaking of God, which is primarily a monotheistic hangup. With so many gods, one could not help referring one to another, and therefore inevitably slighting some god or other, and it didn't matter if you insulted gods who made no claim to omnipotence or omniscience, and certainly not to benevolence. Texts in this period, therefore, were able quite confidently to get away with what non-Hindus might regard as blasphemous attitudes to Hindu gods. They told stories in which Shiva committed adultery and cheated at dice, Vishnu violated Dharma by killing a woman, Krishna made love to married women, Brahma lied, and so forth. But for most Hindus throughout history, blasphemy in the sense of C, impious irreverence to the Brahmins, was indeed a problem. A dharma, that is non-dharma or anti-dharma, let's call it undharma, the opposite of Dharma, is not type A blasphemy, which nobody cared about. Undharma means BC, not behaving properly, offending the Brahmins, and you could get into big trouble for that. And so people were far more circumspect in what they said about Brahmins than about gods. For instance, the lawmaker Manu in the 2nd century CE does not mention any punishment for verbal abuse of the gods, but he prescribes serious fines for the verbal abuse of Brahmins, depending upon the class of the offender, higher fines for lower classes. And Manu continues, quote, "If a man of low birth hurls cruel words at a Brahmin, his tongue should be cut out. If he mentions his name or casts maliciously, a red hot iron nail 10 fingers long should be thrust into his mouth. If he is so proud as to instruct Brahmins about their duty, the king should have hot oil poured into his mouth and ears." End quote. The textbook of politics, the Arthashastra of Kautilya, composed during the same approximate period as Manu, is far more lenient than Manu in the prosecution for verbal abuse. It prescribes for all classes, unlike Manu who discriminates between them, fines but no physical punishment for, quote, "insults relating to body, character, learning, occupation, and country, for an insult relating to the body with words such as one-eyed and lame, and the fine is doubled if the insult is untrue," a circumstance that Manu doesn't take into consideration at all. The Arthashastra also prescribes fines for, quote, "disdain couched as praise of people who are one-eyed, lame, and the like, saying, what beautiful eyes you have." And for referring to people as lepers, insane, or impotent. But the Arthashastra occasionally does take class into account. It doubles these fines if the insult is directed at superiors, and halves them if directed at inferiors or done through negligence, intoxication, or folly. When someone of a lower caste, the text says, insults someone higher, such as by saying vile Brahmin, a significant example from this text, the fine is incrementally increased depending upon the degree of difference between the classes. And when someone higher insults someone lower, it decreases depending upon the degree of difference. Yet it was safe to mock Brahmins in some ways. Sanskrit plays from this period almost always have a court jester, Vidushika, who is a Brahmin and speaks Sanskrit, in contrast with lower castes and women who speak a dialect. But this jester is a greedy, idiotic buffoon. The image of the fat and gluttonous Brahmin is also common in other texts of this period. But people would usually not dare to imply that Brahmins perform sacrifice only for the money or the food. It was the sacrifice and caste dharma that you had to watch out for. Texts of this period therefore had to tread lightly in their critique of dharma and what they said about the Brahmin occupation of performing religious rituals. Words are dangerous, or at least punishable. Under the circumstances, it is amazing that some texts said as much as they did. How did they do it? They managed a brilliant end run around Dharma using two techniques. First, the bookend technique, and then the straw man technique. I'll explain these one by one. Bookends. Some texts use a technique somewhat like the trick that Hollywood producers adopted to get around the strict moral code, the motion picture production code, enforced from the Hays office from 1930 to 1968, which forbade the depiction of a successful crime in a film, and other things, but that's the one. So the film Ocean's 11, for instance, 1960, in that film, Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack execute a brilliant and entirely successful robbery of all the Las Vegas casinos, only to watch at the last minute all their money get burned up in an incinerated coffin in an accident that has nothing to do with them. Such tacked-on endings allowed Hollywood to violate the Hays Office code in the body of the movie. In The Postman Always Rings Twice, they commit a successful murder, successful adultery, they're driving away happily with the money and the dead husband and all of that, and he leans over to kiss her and loses control of the car and they hit a tree and she dies. has nothing to do with the successful adulthood and murder. Similarly, the Arthashastra and other texts, including the Kama Sutra, the textbook of erotics, composed slightly later, texts such as these pretend to care about Dharma and pay lip service to it at the start and finish of the book, like bookends. But on almost every page of the actual text, they violate Dharma. The Arthashastra by advocating violence and trickery, the Kama Sutra by facilitating adultery. Their subversions of Dharma in this way manage to lodge in the body of normative texts an antinomian tradition, a pervasive undharmic agenda coated with a thin veneer of Dharma. Thus, like a driver with one foot on the brakes and another on the accelerator, certain Indian texts ricochet between the praise of Dharma and the need to undermine Dharma. As for the straw man technique, it's the custom in the ancient Indian textbook tradition first to cite the opponent's opinion, known as the prior faction, the Purvapaksha, often without explicitly noting that it is, in the author's view, incorrect, and then to state the author's own correct opinion, setting up opponents as straw men and demolishing them. But texts will also sometimes quote older scholars or opposing schools in order to say rather extreme things that they really believe themselves but do not want to own as their own, to get them on the table and then say, oh no, don't do that, in much the manner that a lawyer might reveal evidence to a jury and then, when reprimanded by the judge, say the jury will disregard those remarks. It's not always easy to tell apart these two agendas, setting up straw men to demolish and using stalking horses to say what you yourself do not dare to say outright, since they both take the same form of ostensible disagreement. The prior faction technique thus serves ancient texts as a very useful way of challenging Dharma without seeming to challenge it. Their technique represents what James Scott has taught us to call a hidden transcript, a subversive transcript, one of the arts of resistance, getting people to do what you want without a fight, soft power. Example of this, for instance, in the Arthashastra. He says, now some people say to the king, as soon as you have sons born, you should murder them all, because eventually they'll try to take the throne. Now, other people say, don't murder them, just lock them up. And other people say, help them to work far away in the elephant forests. And that's what I think, says Kautilya, the author. Just put them to work. So no one ever said, murder all your sons, right? But he pretends that someone said it so that he can say, you know, you could actually murder them. I don't think so, but you could. The worlds these texts thus imagined largely disregarded rather than challenged the power of Brahmins. The texts were perpetuated by Brahmins, no one else wrote Sanskrit texts at this period, under the noses of other more conventional, traditional, uptight Brahmins. This was not a class struggle. The text therefore had a very limited direct effect on the actual lives of most people in ancient India, but they are highly significant in their implications for freedom of speech for intellectuals, for their indirect effect may well have been widely diffused through the general population. And this is how. The knowledge of Sanskrit was limited to a very small, highly elite group, consisting primarily of men, and among them primarily Brahmins, with a sprinkling of nobles and wealthy merchants, and some women as well, and they alone would have been able to read these texts in the original. But the ideas in the texts were far more widely diffused, as the Kama Sutra explains, in justifying its assertion that women should become familiar with its contents. This is a Sanskrit text, and this is what the Kama Sutra says. Throughout the world, in all subjects, there are only a few people who know the text, but the practice is with the range of everyone. And a text, however far removed, is the ultimate source of the practice. Grammar is a science, people say, yet the sacrificial priests, who are no grammarians, know how to gloss the words in the sacrificial prayers. Astronomy is a science, they say, but ordinary people perform the rituals on the days when the skies are auspicious. And people know how to ride horses and elephants without studying the texts about horses and elephants. The case of women learning the Kama Sutra is like those examples." End quote. So we may assume that the ideas, including the antinomian ideas, the anti-dharmic or undharmic ideas of these texts, could have been known far beyond the narrow circle of Brahmin readers. I should say male Brahmin readers. An important instance of the prior faction technique can be seen in the case of people known as materialists, sometimes called skeptics. People who express seriously or sometimes hilariously undharmic ideas. The straw man citations of materialists in ancient Indian texts, Buddhist as well as Hindu, but today I'll just talk about Hindu texts. These straw man citations reveal numerous places where resistance to the dharmic party line was present. The Kama Sutra, for instance, says that the materialists say this. We don't say this, but the materialists say this, quote, they say, the Kama Sutra says they say, "People should not perform acts of dharma, for their results are in the world to come, and that is doubtful. Who but a fool would take what is in his own hand and put it in someone else's hand? Better a pigeon today than a peacock tomorrow. And better a copper coin that is certain than a gold coin that is doubtful." End quote. So this is the prior faction, the opponent's incorrect argument about dharma. Don't believe in anything you can't see. Don't waste your money on sacrifice and hope of the existence of a heaven with gods who will receive your offerings and give you something in return. The author then blows this argument out of the water, coming to the defense of dharma. But we have already heard and will not forget the attack on dharma. An early mockery of materialist views appears in the Ramayana, a great Sanskrit poem, 200 BCE to 200 CE, it's written over many centuries, it's a very long poem. When a man named Jabali urges Prince Rama, the hero of the Ramayana, to ignore family obligations and live for pleasure alone, and he offers this argument, he says, "People here busy themselves with the rite for the ancestors, but just look at the waste of food. You're supposed to feed the ancestors. You actually feed the Brahmins and the ghost ancestors. But just look at the waste of food. What really is a dead man going to eat? And if something one person eats here could fill the belly of someone else, one could simply offer the sacrificial offering for a traveler, and he would need no provisions for the road. It was only as a charm to secure themselves donations that cunning men, i.e. Brahmins, compose those books that tell us, sacrifice, give alms, sanctify yourself, practice asceticism, renounce. Accept the idea once and for all that there exists no world to come." That's what Jabali says. So Jabali may merely be acting as the devil's advocate to stir Rama into righteous indignation, which is actually what happens, or he may mean it. The argument that he offers, accusing the Brahmins of being in it just for the money and mocking the idea of feeding ancestors who are not physically present and of a heaven to come, was to be repeated for centuries when anyone wanted to satirize materialists. To my present knowledge, and you never should say this in public, but this is all I know at the moment, this passage in the Ramayana is the first instance of such an accusation and may be implicitly quoted in all the subsequent citations, hundreds of them throughout Sanskrit literature, the materialists say this bad stuff. Other texts usually add one more bit of blasphemy. If you believe that the sacrificial beast goes to heaven, why don't you sacrifice your own father and send him to heaven too? That's the sort of thing that no one ever could have really said, right? But they're said to say. The Kama Sutra lists materialists along with fatalists and pragmatists. These are not philosophical schools, but types of persons. People who care only about material wealth and having fun. As we might speak of a person as a Stoic or an Epicurean, not someone who follows the Roman philosophies, but just someone who enjoys a good bottle of wine. The materialists were said to engage in the ancient Indian brand of blasphemy, attacking the sacrifice of the Brahmins. But they were not accused of blasphemy in our terms. They didn't bother to attack the gods, which everyone was doing anyway and getting away with. Our knowledge of the materialist, however, is only secondary and fragmentary, based entirely on criticism of their ideas by other schools. It never was a living tradition. We have no examples of any materialist texts. All we have is quotation from materialists and other texts which disapprove of them strongly. It's my belief that the materialists never existed as a school at all, but were invented by a Brahmin or a group of Brahmins as a way of smuggling blasphemous ideas into their own texts under the pretext of disapproving of them. Materialists continue to be mocked in this double way, ostensibly to condemn, secretly to propagate, despite major changes in attitudes toward blasphemy in the period of bhakti, the passionate devotion to individual gods, starting around the 6th century CE. At this time, some Hindu sects behaved much more like monotheistic religions, positing a single deity and, unlike most other forms of Hinduism, actively seeking converts. The South Indian Shaivas, worshippers of the god Shiva, even mocked their own proselytizing. They told this story. A Shaiva saint was a great proselytizer. He converted those of this world by any means whatever, love, money, brute force. One day, Shiva came down, the god himself, came down in disguise to test him. But the devotee did not recognize Shiva and proceeded to convert him, forcing holy ash on the reluctant-seeming god. When his zeal became too oppressive, Shiva tried to tell him who he was, but the baptism of ash was still forced on him. Even Shiva had to become a Shaiva. During this period and among these sects, there were occasionally violent conflicts both with other Hindu sects and with other religions, particularly Jains, but also Buddhists. A character in the 9th century satirical play entitled The Brouhaha About Doctrines complains that a cruel king has been rounding up certain undharmic Shaiva mendicants, beggars, beating them up and expelling them for violating Dharma. One of them remarks, "We drink booze, eat meat, have women." That's violating Dharma. And they say that the king threatens to kill them or throw them in prison. If this is a reflection of actual historical policy, for which there is other scattered evidence, it would mean that such groups were in fact actively prosecuted at this time. Later, the Bhakti movement changed again in response to the monotheist philosophies of Islam. For the arrival of Islam in India stimulated the need to compete with a proselytizing monotheistic religion, a presence that enhanced and complexified already present elements of monotheism in Hinduism. Some of the Bhakti sects, as a result, became orthodox as well as orthoprax, predisposing them to defend their doctrines as well as their practices against those who differed from them. At the same time, the more worldly strain of Hinduism lived on in bhakti groups too, as the devotees, the bhaktas, wrote erotic love poems to the gods, particularly, but not only Krishna, and other poems in which they threatened to worship other gods if the god in question didn't do what they asked. To this day, many Hindus spank the statues of gods who do not respond to their prayers. The situation changed again. This is a gallop through Indian history here. This is the British now. The situation changed again when the British colonized India. As not only Protestants, but Victorian Protestants, the British rejected as filthy paganism the sensuous strain of ritual polytheistic Hinduism, all those kitschy images of gods with all those arms. It reminded them of Catholicism. But they respected the more ascetic strain of philosophy, including Indian monism and idealism, so appealing to European philosophers from Schlegel to Hegel, and the Bhagavad Gita, so appealing to the American transcendentalists, and the monotheistic strains of bhakti, on the whole a more reasonable sort of religion, the British thought. The British also tended to prefer the company of Muslims to Hindus for a number of reasons, partly their horsemanship, but also the simple fact that Islam was a monotheism that revered the Hindu Bible and the Christian New Testament. Some Protestants within the British Raj tried to recast Hinduism as a monotheism with the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, thus also validating the worship of Krishna, the god of the Gita, as a monotheistic god. The Hindus were doubly inspired to position the Gita as their Bible, both in response to British pressure and in competition with the Muslims, whose monotheism contributed greatly to the Hindus' desire to elevate the monotheistic Gita as the counterpart to the Muslim Quran over polytheistic Hinduism. But as Pankaj Mishra has noted recently, the psychic wounds that Naipaul noticed among semi-westernized upper caste Hindus and that Hindu nationalists often blame on the Muslims actually date not from the period of Muslim rule in which Hinduism thrived under the new stimulus, but to the Indian elite's humiliating encounter with the geopolitical and cultural dominance first of Europe and then of America. Focusing on the single text of the Gita ignored the many other texts in which other gods such as Shiva were similarly represented as the one and only God. He apologized, he has to clap. Moreover, the Gita had never had anything remotely approaching canonical status before this, though it had always been an important text. Other texts, Sanskrit texts such as the Upanishads and vernacular texts such as the Hindi and Tamil versions of the Ramayana, and most of all, oral traditions, were what most Hindus actually used in their worship. The many English-speaking Hindus who worked for and with the British came to accept British evaluation of Hinduism and developed several new forms of so-called reformed Hinduism, such as the Brahmo Samaj and later the Arya Samaj, which valued the philosophical, ascetic aspect of Hinduism and devalued the worldly, householder aspect. Such Hindus were particularly embarrassed by the erotic mythology of the god Krishna. They went about trying to silence the love songs to the gods to cover up the erotic sculptures and to kick the temple dancers out of the temples. This sanitized strain of Hinduism, also sometimes called Sanatana Dharma, the eternal law, was just one form among many, and a minor strain at that. It thrived primarily among the middle castes, who aspired to raise their social class by aping Victorians. This whole strategy aping the much older Hindu strategy of lower classes aping Brahmins, in a process that the great sociologist M.N. Srinivas called Sanskritization. Those at the very bottom who have very little chance of improving their status, and those at the very top who don't have to, were and are far less touched by such foreign values. Indeed, those at the top and the bottom went on telling their stories and dancing their dances and worshiping their many gods. But the middle castes began to enforce the idea of orthodoxy and to embrace the concept of blasphemy against the gods. Now, for the first time, Hindus of one sort not only devalued, but denied other Hindus. Yet they could not sue them, for there was no law against blasphemy in India, not even in British India. British law in India upheld freedom of speech, so the authorities needed to employ other means of controlling possibly subversive voices. The laws against libel and sedition became the British Empire's censorship tools in the subcontinent. Prime among these was Indian Penal Code 295A, which was passed in 1927 at a time of serious conflicts between Hindus, particularly Arya Samaj Hindus, and Muslims. In 1927, a book entitled Promiscuous or Married Prophet, written by an Arya Samaji, about the marriages and sex life of the Prophet Muhammad, based on the Hadiths, inspired legal action by a Muslim complainant. The publisher, Raj Lal, who did not divulge the name of the author, was arrested. Though he was acquitted in April 1929, having argued that there was no law in India against insulting anyone's religion, he was murdered. When the Muslim community demanded a law against insults to religious feelings, the colonial British government enacted Section 295A, which stated, in part, Whoever, with deliberate and malicious intention of outraging the religious feelings of any class of citizens of India, insults or attempts to insult the religion or the religious beliefs of that class shall be punished with imprisonment of either description for a term which may extend to 3 years, or with fine, or with both." Other cases followed, most of them protesting insults against Islam, and some defending Catholics, that is, defending religious minorities against Hindus. But the situation changed dramatically after Indian independence in 1948, with the rise of a new form of Hindu nationalism, no longer directed against the British, but now against other religions in India, primarily Islam and then Christianity. Hindus have long prided themselves on their tolerance, and indeed the worldly, polytheistic, orthoprax strain of Hindus has always been admirably tolerant of the beliefs, if not necessarily the actions, of other religions. But Hindus of the more orthodox strain remain intolerant of any slur cast against their tolerance. Shortly after partition, N.S. Golwalkar, a member of the Nationalist and Anti-Muslim Hindu Association, the RSS, remarked that since Hindus are, as is well known, the most tolerant people in the world, they deserve to have the land of India to themselves, and therefore the less tolerant Muslims should be disenfranchised. This is what he said, and I quote, "The spirit of broad Catholicism, generosity, toleration, truth, sacrifice, and love for all life, which characterizes the average Hindu mind not wholly vitiated by Western influences, bears eloquent testimony to the greatness of Hindu culture. The non-Hindu peoples and Hindu stock must not only give up their attitude of intolerance and ungratefulness toward this land, but must stay in the country wholly subordinated to the Hindu nation, claiming nothing, deserving no privileges, far less any preferential treatment, not even citizens' rights," end quote. And of course, he calls it Hindustan rather than India to make this point. "Not wholly vitiated by Western influence," quote unquote, implies that the British presence made Hindus less tolerant, which is indeed a valid insight, though the implication that this was the only cause of Hindu intolerance is confuted by the history that we have just considered. The rest of the paragraph, beginning with the strangely inappropriate overtones of Catholicism, is of course a paragon of self-contradiction. In India today, the tension between the two old basic forms of Hinduism, the philosophical and eventually monotheistic strain, and the worldly, passionate, polytheistic strain, have again come into direct conflict as some Hindus, the heirs and ghosts of the 19th century Hindus who had come to be so ashamed of aspects of their own religion, have not only denied the authenticity of a part of their own religion, the worldly strain, but tried to erase it. This movement, which also took on a strong nationalist hue, began to call itself Hindutva, Hinduness, a term that was invented by the nationalist Vinayak Damodar Savarkar in his 1923 pamphlet entitled Hindutva, Who is a Hindu? Hindutva is both orthoprax and orthodox, and its adherents have inspired violence against both Muslims and Christians. In 2010, Dinanath Batra, a then 81-year-old school headmaster and member of the RSS, brought the first of a series of civil and criminal actions against me, Penguin Book USA, and Penguin Books India, arguing that my book, The Hindus and Alternative History, violated Article 295A of the Indian Penal Code that we've been discussing. Penguin India drafted its lawyers to defend the suit, but after 4 years, and after Bertelsmann and Pearson had bought Penguin India, which is a very significant fact, to greatest conglomerates of publishing in the world. After that, Penguin India was forced to abandon the case, agreeing to cease publishing the book. A precedent on the part of the publisher, though it harks back to the Islam-defending rather than the Hinduism-defending era of censorship, occurred on September 26, 1988, when the Penguin Group in the UK published Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses. An earlier instance of Penguin UK's bravery was their defense of Lady Chatterley's Lover in 1960. So Penguin UK were the good guys there. In the Rushdie case in 1988, however, Penguin India, nervous about possible repercussions, decided not to publish a local edition. And indeed, within 9 days of the London publication, India banned the Satanic Verses, becoming the first country to do so. In my case, the heroes and villains among the Penguins were reversed. This time it was Penguin India who bravely took on the book and defended it for 4 years, and Penguin International after the big takeover in July 2013 by Random House, Bertelsmann and Pearson, forced Penguin Random House in India to drop the suit. So Penguin in India still, as far as I'm concerned, smells like a rose, but Penguin UK does not. This led to two widespread misunderstandings. First, the book was never banned, for it never reached the courts or the Indian government. There was just a lawsuit and then an out-of-court agreement between two private parties, the Bhatra Brigade and the publishers. And second, Penguin did agree to pulp all remaining copies, but as it turned out, not a single book was destroyed. Everyone rushed to the bookstore and bought them entirely out within 3 or 4 days. There was no book to burn. Indeed, the USA edition of the book is currently being sold through the Penguin India website and is also available at the Delhi Airport and Khan Market, widely available. All of this renders Bhatra's victory hollow, but the words banned and pulped continue to be used to fan the flames of media indignation. The verb pulping conjures up ugly images of Germany in the 1930s, and indeed, a Harvard-trained economist who is a Hindu recently demanded a public bonfire of canonical books by liberal and secular Indian historians and intellectuals who contradict the doctrines of the RSS. But this emphasis on the physicality of books ignores the important and ambivalent effect of the internet in all of this. As part of the problem, spreading lies to millions of people in just seconds, but also part of the solution, since banned and pulped books are easily available in India through illegal PDFs. Turning to the content rather than the form of the book, the idea that you could be prosecuted for insulting the god, in contrast with the Brahmin, is, as we have seen, very un-Indian. But this is what Bhatra accused me of. The suit against my book begins. Suit for deletion of defamatory, derogatory, insulting, and objectionable passages referring to freedom fighters of Indian national movement and also to Hindu gods and goddesses from the book, namely The Hindus and Alternative History. And then a few lines later, the book also defames youth icon Swami Vivekananda when it states that on being asked what he will eat, Swami Vivekananda replied, "Give me beef," end quote, end quote. It's surely significant that the freedom fighters come first before the gods, a clear sign that nationalism drives this whole business far more than piety. This hypothesis is supported by Bhatra's other activities in the past and present. When the BJP came to power before, in this, the right-wing party that's now in power, when they came to power before in 1999, they instituted a policy of censorship of all the textbooks in India. And the man they put in charge of that project was none other than Bhatra. School textbooks pose a special problem for freedom of speech because unlike books that can compete in the market with other books that challenge their assertions, textbooks present a child with a single interpretation, usually the first that the child has heard about the subject in question. Textbooks, therefore, have a far more serious effect on the public understanding of that subject than other sorts of books have. Bhatra's revisions included the claim that the Taj Mahal, the Qutub Minar, and the Red Fort, three of India's outstanding examples of Islamic architecture, were designed and commissioned by Hindus. In the BJP schools, students were told that child marriage, jauhar, sati, and various superstitions were all due to fear of the Muslims. The revisionist histories insisted that the ancient Indians knew about airplanes. One Rajasthan government history textbook claimed not only that ancient India had the nuclear bomb, but even practiced non-proliferation by carefully restricting the number of people who had access to it, presumably to Brahmins. The revisionists also demanded that several prominent historians should be arrested. More significant than what was added was what was taken out. Awkward facts like the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi by a Hindu nationalist in 1948 were simply left out of the textbooks. Even to mention, let alone to discuss or explore beef eating in ancient India, the destruction by Hindus of Buddha stupas and giant temples was denounced as evidence of unpatriotism and of Christian-Muslim designs. They also deleted passages about the history and function of the caste system. I took it upon myself to put such passages back into the history of Hinduism, and that's where I ran headlong into Mr. Batra. He has sworn that he will continue to wage war against all those who write books like Donner's. Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister, endorsed Batra's books when he was Gujarat Chief Minister, and he has set him to altering textbooks again now that he is Prime Minister. When an RSS propagandist was asked what changes he hoped to see after the election, he began by saying that Wendy Doniger's book, The Hindus, recently withdrawn from publication in India, should not be out in the Western press. He called for an overhaul of government textbooks, which he said included insulting language about Hindu gods and excessive praise of the Muslim emperor Akbar. I was flattered to be linked with Akbar, one of the first and greatest religious pluralists, but as for the RSS coming after the Western press for my book, I was reminded of Humphrey Bogart's retort as Rick in the film Casablanca, to the Nazi officer who suggested that the Nazis might conquer New York. "Well," said Rick, "there are certain sections of New York, Major, that I wouldn't advise you to try to invade." National pride about science plays a bizarre role in these attacks as science and religion blend together to produce weird anachronisms, I should say, and politics. As recently as October 28th of this year, Modi publicly said that the statement that Karna, a warrior hero in the Mahabharata, the other great Indian epic, was not born from his mother's womb means, quote, that genetic science was present at that time, end quote. And that the statement that the god Ganesha was given an elephant's head means that, quote, there must have been some plastic surgeon at that time. Other Hindus have argued that the Vedic people discovered America long before Columbus, who was therefore actually right when he called the Native Americans Indians. This is all about nationalism, creepily reminiscent of the Soviet Union's Cold War claims to have invented the telephone. It's not, or at least not primarily, about piety. But it is also about piety. The lawsuit against me objects that, quote, the cover page of the book shows picture of Lord Krishna sitting on buttocks of a naked woman and surrounded by other naked women, and hence depicts Lord Krishna in a vulgar, base, and perverse manner with the malicious intent to outrage the religious feelings of Hindus as a community, end quote. The Arya Samajis in the 19th century objected to similar depictions of Krishna, but did not yet argue about malicious intent to outrage religious feelings. Perhaps this is progress, perhaps not. The issue calls, in conclusion, the issue calls for a nuanced judgment on whether the hurt in question constitutes simply a lying insult against a group religion or caste, which could lead to violent disorder, making it the equivalent of slander against an individual, or whether the hurt constitutes a reasoned argument or artistic venture intended to uncover the meaning of or contradictions within a particular set of texts. The territory of 295A is a treacherous no man's land in which to maneuver. To prove that one had or did not have deliberate and malicious intention of outraging religious feelings is a slippery matter. In my case, to show that in one of the instances singled out by Batra, Vivekananda did indeed advise people to eat beef, that I didn't get it wrong or fabricated the lying insult, is no defense. To state an unpleasant truth can be hurtful and is therefore still illegal. Perhaps to show that it is widely known that Vivekananda said that, and therefore by mentioning it I didn't make the situation any worse, nor did I intend to do so, might be a defense. Perhaps not. Pankaj Mishra said, "Today a new generation of Indian nationalists lurches between victimhood and chauvinism, and with ominous implications." Modi is therefore stoking old Hindu rage and shame over what he calls more than 1,000 years of slavery under Muslim and British rule. But Hinduism remains a gloriously rich mix of the many ancient and still vibrant strains of this great civilization. Thank you.